Blog Talk Radio.
Of life, I just picked me a plum. You came along and everything started to hum. Still, it's a real good bet, the best is yet to come.
Yes, the best is yet to come. We have a new Pope. You ain't seen the sun because you ain't seen it shine yet. Wait till the warm-up's underway. See nothing yet. We have a new Pope, St. Francis. Well, as my grandsons say, St. Francis, how are you today? How are the animals? How are all the people? See, in my church, the Lady Consolation Catholic Church here in Charlotte, North Carolina, right as you walk up the side of the church, there's a statue about 4.5 feet tall of St. Francis of Assisi. When we go to church on Saturday, which that's when we normally go, if my grandkids are with me, they stop and they both talk to St. Francis. And my wife taught them that. She taught them to say hello to St. Francis and taught them about St. Francis. So the other day when the youngest one came over, I haven't seen the oldest one yet, when the youngest one came over, he had the biggest smile on his face because he goes to Our Lady of Assumption Catholic School here in Charlotte, and they must have been talking about it. But he said, Saint Francis is the new Pope. Well, he gets them a little mixed up. Saint Francis has been dead a long time, but he thinks that he actually knows our new Pope because we talked about Francis of Assisi so much. We're going to be talking about that. We are definitely going to be talking about St. Francis of Assisi. We're going to be talking about, I have an interview, part two of our interview with Father Carl from Our Lady of Consolation, which was another great interview. And we're going to have him back from time to time, giving us a little here and there on the things that are going on. Let me give you a little information on what else we got going today. I want everybody to remember, April the 6th, the 8th District Black Leadership Caucus is having their annual banquet in Union County at 6109 West Marshfield Boulevard. Well, that's where they're located at, but the banquet is going to be at the Union County Agricultural Center, 3230 D, Presser Road, Monroe. That's going to be April the 6th at 6 o'clock. Tickets are $25. Now, if you also want to contribute and help the 8th District Black Leadership Caucus, you can get, they're selling pages. Oh, they're selling half a page for $50, whole page ads for $100, whole page ad with two tickets, $150. Patrons will pay $5. Who are patrons? I don't know who they are. I have to find out. And the tickets are $25. But April the 6th at the Union County Agricultural Center, 3230 6:30, Presser Road, Monroe, North Carolina. And the speaker will be the Honorable Larry Hall, who represents House District 20, the 29th House District in Durham. He will be the guest speaker, and we will also have the chairman of the North Carolina Legislative Caucus there, Mr. Walter Rice. So, have I cleaned up stuff here? And, hey, listen, by the way, we had Joe Ford, Representative Joe Ford, on our show last week, and he did, I mean, he really gave us a lot of things about the bill that he's sponsoring called Senate Bill 235, Voter Protection Integrity, Every Vote Counts Bill. We need to make sure, you go to the website, or just type in Senate Bill 235, North Carolina, and if you want to get a hold of the senator, you can follow up by calling 919-715-8366. That's 919-715-8366. Or you can email him at ford.porter@ncleg.net. So, but that's a great bill, and you can read about that bill, SB 235. Now, are these Republicans wackos? Do they ever want to win another national office? Are they just fooling? That's all I ask. Are they just fooling? I mean, what the heck? Are these people just fooling? How the heck are these people going through the same nonsense that lost them the election in November of 2012? CPAC, you're right, they are insignificant. You know, it's like when you have an all-star game. You bring all the all-stars. You don't even bring the people to bat in baseball 125 or 045. You bring the people that hit home runs. You bring the people that bat over 300. You bring the people that steal 100 bases. You bring the people that have the best batting average, that are batting 350. You don't bring people at that 145 to make 14 errors in the field in one game. As my grandfather used to say to Major, that guy's got to pay his way to get in the ballpark the next time. Well, these people at who they invited to speak at CPAC should be paying their way to speak at CPAC. You got nothing but losers. You got that clown, Alan West. Oh, please, don't mind. I mean, it just boggles my mind. It boggles my mind. I mean, you have people. Let me just tell you, this is what you're going to get from Alan West.
What percentage of American legislators do you think are card-carrying Marxists or
neo-Marxists?
I believe there's about 78 to 81 members of the Democrat Party that are members of the House of
Representatives. I mean, this is what this man said. There's 78 to 81 members of the Democratic Party that are communists. I mean, give me a break. And then you have people like this.
And I will tell you, it's three agencies of government when I get there that are gone. Commerce, education, and the, what's the third one there? Let's see.
Five.
Oh, five. Okay. So commerce, education, and
EPA?
EPA. There you go. No, okay.
Let's stop getting it.
Seriously? Is EPA the one you were talking about? Or?
No, sir. We were talking about the agencies of government. EPA needs to be rebuilt.
But you
no
can't.
Doubt about
but you
that.
Can't name the third one.
The third agency of government.
Yeah.
I would do away with the education, commerce, and let's see. I can't. The third one. I can't. Sorry. Oops.
What? Oops. This is the other guy they invited. And then you get defining achievement at all.
Mark Morrill, the president of the National Urban League, sent something the other day, and I want to give you a chance to respond to it. He was talking about a comment you made at a rally out in Iowa this past Sunday, and you told an audience there that you don't want to, quote, make black people's lives better by giving them somebody else's money. How would you respond to that sentence?
I would respond a couple of ways. First off, Mark Morrell and I have worked together on a number of issues, and he knows quite well how much work I've done in the African-American community. I've worked with him at the Urban League. I've worked with him when he was mayor of New Orleans. And the other thing is I've looked at that quote. In fact, I looked at the video. And I don't, in fact, I'm pretty confident I didn't say black. What I think, I started to say a word and sort of mumbled it and changed my thought. But I don't recall saying black. No one in that audience, no one listening, no reporter there heard me say that. I think it was, and from everything I see, and I've looked at it several times, I was starting to say one word, and I sort of came up with a different word and moved on, and it sounded like black. But I can assure you.
Are you kidding me?
The word.
Are you kidding me?
Just this past Sunday in Iowa, Santorum was talking about entitlement programs.
So I don't want to make live people's lives better by giving them somebody else's money.
What did he just say? He said, I want to give black people's entitlement to give somebody else's money. What are we talking about here? These are the people that you got, which, Sarah Palin? Sarah Palin? Sarah Palin? Who didn't even finish her governorship? Because he saw a way to get out of it. Because anybody, the polar bear can manage Dagon in Alaska. Every member, every citizen of Alaska gets money from the oil companies. Every citizen who's a citizen of Alaska gets money. They share in the wealth up there. This woman's, the polar bear, Bigfoot can manage Alaska. They have more people in my high school than they have in Alaska. I mean, then you've got this Rubio, the water drinker. He's there. I mean, you know, the person who is supposed to make, the rebuttal for the President of the United States, State of the Union message. That's the person that you have at CPAC. That's who you have. I mean, what are these people completely insane? And then, of course, you have this person.
There are 47% of the people who vote for the president no matter what. All right, there are 47% who are with him, who are dependent upon government, who believe that they are victims, who believe that government has a responsibility to care for them, who believe that they are entitled to health care, to food, to housing, to you name it. But that's an entitlement, and the government should give it to them. And they will vote for this president no matter what. And I mean, the president starts off with 48, 49, 43. He starts off with a huge number. These are people who pay no income tax. 47% of Americans pay no income tax. So our message of low taxes doesn't connect. And you'll be out there talking about tax cuts for the rich. I mean, that's what they sell every 4 years. And so my job is not to worry about those people. I'll never convince them. They should take personal responsibility and care for their lives. What I have to do is convince the 5 to 10% in the center that are independent, that are thoughtful, that look at voting one way or the other, depending upon some cases, emotion, whether they like the guy or not.
That's their standard there. 47%. We pay no income tax. You pay plenty of sales tax, plenty of city tax, plenty of state tax, just no federal income tax. Like he doesn't. I bet you if we got those 6 previous years, we were able to look at them, he didn't pay any either. And then we have the old standby. Yes, the old standby. who spoke today? Eddie Paul Ryan Munster. Yep. Saying the same bull that he said for an entire 2 years. Balancing the budget on the backs of the poor, the old, and the young. Get rid of Obamacare. Oh, but that savings that you save with Obamacare, that $716 billion, I'm going to put that in my program. Well, how do you get it if you don't use Obamacare? Well, that doesn't matter. I'm going to put it in my program anyway. This CPAC fiasco is a circus. The only thing they haven't called it is Ringling Brothers, because they would be sued by Ringling Brothers. But they're certainly doing the promenade elephant walk this afternoon. Well, I have a little thing that I want to play for everybody here. And I want you to, if you didn't see it on television, it's a 6 minute clip, but I want you to feel, you can feel everything that those more than 100,000 people felt, and people, the millions around the world that watched it, when the white smoke came up, and just after.
Announces the name of the new pope. You hear the crowd picking up in intensity, their reaction.
Cardinal Bergoglio.
Qui sibi nomen imposui Franciscum.
Francisco. He has taken the name Franciscum.
This, the proto deacon announced that we have news of great joy, a new pope, and the pope was Cardinal Bergoglio, who I believe comes from Argentina, who it is said that in the last papal conclave, he actually received a lot of the votes there, kind of the runner-up behind Cardinal Ratzinger. And then he said that this pope had taken the name, the papal name, I believe, of Francis, which would be the first pope who's taken the name Francis.
I was just going to say, he's from Argentina. He is 76 years old, but the fact that he is from Argentina is extraordinary.
Yes.
You have to understand the history that is being made here. 42% of the world's Catholics now come from Latin America. He did come in, by a lot of reports, second to Joseph Ratzinger at the last papal conclave. Many people believe that at 76 he was too old, and so you didn't hear his name. It was not taken seriously. This is an extraordinary moment. moment in the Catholic Church. It's an extraordinary moment throughout Latin America. You can only imagine the reaction that is going on there. This is the part of the world where the Catholic Church has been growing, where vocations have been growing, and they are getting ready to unfurl. And Liz, this is your area of history, this beautiful papal banner.
Yes, they're putting out a papal banner. However, the papal banner does not yet have a coat of arms. The difference between this papal banner is that this is for our brand new pope. We're seeing him for the first time. We just heard his name, Francis I, for the very first time. And then the next time we see the banner come out, the new pope will have chosen his coat of arms. And that banner will be filled with whatever image that this new pope, Francis, chooses to take.
Let me talk about the significance of what he's known for.
Quickly, this is someone who is known as a vocal advocate for the poor. If he is known for one thing, it is that. And to Chris Matthews' point and what you've been talking about, Cameron, the church has wanted to also point out the things they are doing in the world that are positive. And they certainly have a long history of the poor and the oppressed, helping people throughout the world. This is a pope who has spoken about this extensively and in fact has made it one of the causes of his life.
In fact, the name is a very important indication. I was thinking that this really addresses the things that Chris Matthews was bringing up. Francis, who was married to poverty, Francis, whose commitment to the poor, the humble, the marginalized, the people who were left out, this new name, first name, what an amazing statement for a great change in the church.
Father Martinez, let me bring you in on this, to the point of, for so many years, we've heard conversations of the desire to have a pope from Latin America, the politics of it, the representation, and here we are at this moment that, quite honestly, we've talked about year upon year. I'm from Texas. We know the influence of the church in Hispanic communities around the world. But here we are now, Argentina, the Archbishop of Argentina, and now he's the church leader. What is the major message you believe has been sent at this moment?
Well, I think there's a bunch of messages. First of all, the fact that it was chosen on the first full day of voting shows that the cardinals most likely were very much in agreement. On the type of person they wanted and on this person in particular. And that's important. The new pope has to be able to form a team, to work very closely with the bishops throughout the world, with the cardinals, so that they came to an agreement quickly shows that there was a lot of agreement. They're kind of all on the same page. I think that's important to keep in mind. And then Cardinal Bergoglio, I actually had a chance to meet him a few years ago during one of the Synod of Bishops. And what struck me most about him is, although he is he's very respected as a theologian, he's very respected as a pastor, someone who knows how to run a diocese, someone who's had experience as a pastor, but also he's always been one of the a major speaker at most of the synods of bishops and a lot of the different types of meetings in the Curia, so he's very well known. But what struck me personally when I met him, I was a young priest at the time, and I just kind of met him during a coffee break, and I didn't even realize that, you know, I barely realized he was a cardinal, except for the color of his sash. He was so down to earth, and he was so real and sincere, the way that he treated me and the way he treated everyone else. It was only later, when I kind of asked around who was that I realized that he was someone who had so much respect among the other cardinals.
And we actually have video of
Cardinal Jorge Mario Bergoglio is now Francis the First. I mean, you actually felt something. You actually felt something if you watched that whole 6 minutes and then what preceded after it. I'll, in future shows, I'll play a little bit of it, but I want to go right now to an interview with Father Carl of Lady of Consolation Catholic Church, part two of our interview. He's the pastor here in Charlotte, North Carolina. My church. That's correct. This is the last word, March 15, 2013, Friday. And we're here with part two of our interview with Father Carl. The conclave is over. It was so
enthralling. Because this is the first time they ever had cameras that went into the Sistine Chapel, show them march in. First time ever.
Mm-hmm.
And the murals on the wall, they showed the I don't know, what do you call the table? It's not a dais. What do you call that? The table where they were going to put their all the envelopes in. It almost looked like an altar. But it maybe it is an altar.
It may have been a wooden altar table.
Okay.
Yeah.
And this is just amazing. I believe there's 115 cardinals, 14 from Latin America, 60 from Europe. And Europe has controlled it for, I don't know how many years. 300 years, has it been? Like 300 years?
Well, I heard Europe? This morning on the news, first non-European pope in 1,000 years.
1,000?
I heard that this morning on the news. Yeah.
Unbelievable. And this was someone that the media and nobody had on their radar.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand, I heard today, was that when it was getting close, when he was doing the voting, he at one point looked up in the heavens and said, "Don't let it be me."
Really?
Yes. It wasn't Dolan. It was one of the cardinals. No, it was a spokesman for them who said that at one time he says, "Don't let it be me." And then at their breakfast or dinner, what was this he said? He said that I can't remember, it was something about, "Oh, why did you all do this to me?" So, you know, it's, I guess now the reality and the burden is now all his.
I think it's going to sink in right now. It'll be a few days. The shock will be over in a few days. Yesterday I said to a few people, Monday morning, when he opens that file folder on his desk.
The file folder. What about the folder Benedict left for him? That's the one, right?
When he opens that up,
he says, "I resign."
He'll know what's going on. At that point, the reality is.
No, he is already. You know, the Letterman came up with the jokes about he's the first gaucho pope.
Oh, really? Oh my God.
And that's Jorge Mario Biagioli. Bergoglio.
Yeah, the other G is a soft G.
Oh, soft G.
Very soft G, yeah.
But he's an Argentinian.
Argentinian, yeah.
But his family is from Italy.
Right.
I guess at that time, when his family came over, a lot of the Italians and as many people they could were trying to get out of town, out of Dodge, because Hitler was coming, marching through. So, you know, there's a lot of, I guess, Italians and Germans down in South America and Argentina.
My understanding is there's quite a few.
Yeah. Yeah,
they got out when they could. Yeah,
got out when they could. Now, do you know anything about this Francis the First?
All I know is that I read in the news this morning in the newspaper. I knew nothing about him, and as soon as I saw who it was winning the election, I went right to the internet, and anything I could find was so scant at that
right.
time. I'm sure now that he is the Pope. There'll be more information about him coming forth. More homework, more research.
Right.
To really fill people's pages, yes. Yeah.
Well, you know, they said that he had a lot of clashes with the governments down there, and that he was their military dictatorship and that. He said he has fought with them quite a bit. And was he the Archbishop of Buenos Aires?
That's correct.
Right. And now he's 76 years old, with one kidney.
Mm-hmm.
He stood tall.
Mm-hmm.
On the balcony. He wasn't bent over. He didn't have a cane. So they say it was 76 is the new 66.
Something like that. Yeah.
But he started out, I think, in his first line or first couple of lines by being, he's supposed to be very, a communicative person. He made deference of himself when he, in the first few lines, that he said when he spoke, but do they wear the mitre? Because I think everyone that I have seen has always worn the mitre when he stood out, when he came out on the balcony.
As Bishop of Rome, he would wear the mitre at official functions.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know if the particular activity is occurring at the balcony or the blessing of the people. if he wears the mitre then, or would you take it off when he did that?
Okay, okay.
These the next pictures you see of him, probably in his installation next Tuesday, he'll have a mitre on as a bishop.
Now, where will that installation be done?
I would take a while, a good guess. It would be at St. Peter's.
St. Peter's?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Would, yeah.
And that's, well, yeah, because I understand now the vice president is going, and all the dignitaries from around the world will be there.
Oh, I think they would.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Sure. Yeah. So, because I heard say when I was coming in here that he's already got Air Force Two booked up. So he's flying over there. Well, I think there's going to be a contingent.
I don't doubt, sure.
Now, he is someone who has been said is a pastor, and that he made sure to have dinner and visited almost every member of his parish once a week. He has dinner with, and chose not to live in the, opulence, but the cardinal's residence. Mm-hmm. He lived in a small apartment. Now, what's he going to see when he goes now into Rome? What is he going to tell these people who are sitting around driving Mercedes-Benz? I mean, boy, that's their worst nightmare. I tell you. Traded for a horse or a donkey?
I made the joke yesterday. He had a two-room apartment in Buenos Aires.
Right.
Well, he's in the Papal Palace now.
Yeah.
He's still got two rooms. His bedroom and his sitting room.
Right.
And about 400 others.
Yes.
Whatever. The numbers, I have no idea. Yeah.
But he said when they were all leaving, he said, look, hey, they had the limousine outside. He said, no, I came on the bus. I'm going back on the bus. And he went on the bus with the rest of the car? No.
I think that's a statement right there.
You think?
I think so. Yeah. You know that he would not abandon or did not wish to leave his brother, priests, bishops, cardinals. He went back with him on the bus. The car's ready. But I think his handlers are probably saying, Holy Father,
yeah.
You got to sit in the bulletproof car.
Yes, exactly. We've seen that story before. No, you go
in the big black car.
That's
because
correct.
It's bulletproof.
That's right.
I can see that kind of thing happening.
Yeah.
But the very fact that he made that gesture.
Yes.
When he was first on the balcony and he told the people, pray for me and bless me.
Right.
I mean, that's a very humble thing to say.
That's right.
Now, the Bishop of Rome,
right.
And the new Bishop of Rome has said, people of Rome, bless me and pray for me, then I will bless you.
Right.
Now, I don't think it's theater or not, but I suspect strongly there may be an indication of what kind of a man he will be in office.
Mm-hmm.
I can only hope so.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Now, one of the reports said that they are losing a lot of Catholics to evangelism in Latin America. And as a matter of fact, they lost more than we gained here. They're losing a lot. And so they hope that maybe this can help turn that tide around. He said that he just can't do the evangelism outreach by himself. So whatever is lacking down in South America, this might turn some of that around. They believe, they hope. But how many languages does he speak? I know he speaks Italian, he speaks Spanish, but I guess he speaks English.
My guess is at least Spanish and Italian, right? I just probably guess that. I don't know if he has any other language skills.
Well, English.
He will probably still learn.
Yeah, but he must speak English.
I have no idea.
Yeah. The Cardinals, well, I guess they're all going to stay here for the installation.
Sure, it's next Tuesday, I think.
Okay, so they'll all stay here for the installation. And what would be the next step from there? That would you think that he would give them some sort of direction now, or just wait till he sees who all the players are and what's on the plate?
I would hope myself. He's certainly still with the Cardinals. Primary job of the Cardinals is to advise.
Right.
They are advisors that I would like to, in my wildest imagination, I would imagine him convening a meeting of the heads,
mm-hmm.
the bishop heads, of all the bishop conferences in the world. Not all the bishops,
right.
Just the heads of the presidents of all those associations. Bring them together and exercise collegial ministry. At least on that level first. whether and find out where each bishop is coming from, what's going on in his country,
mm-hmm.
or the diocese in which they are living, what is happening, and work on a collegial basis to really rejuvenate and reaffirm the collegial ties all bishops are supposed to have together.
Well, what about now, where do the cardinals come in at then? Because, you know, when we talk about the bishop, we're talking about people that actually do the grunt work.
A lot of the cardinals are bishops of their own diocese.
Right.
They would
because he was the bishop of Buenos Aires.
Buenos Aires. So mm-hmm. some of them would still be in the meetings themselves, mm-hmm. sure, yeah.
So who we have, I think we have 19 cardinals in the United States.
Oh, gosh.
Say it's 19. All of them went. Now, since he is so hands-on, I mean, it's like a lot of generals in the military. They had one called, he created the Air Force base over in the Philippines. But he was an enlisted man's general, they called it. And he wanted to do more things for the enlisted man than the officers themselves. Now, that would be a switch because that's the type of person that I see him as, that he would want to be more directly involved with the bishops than the cardinals, because they got theirs. The people that need the help are the bishops and the priests in the parish, in the various parishes. And he can decide how this works. There isn't anything set in stone that, well, you know, you got to speak to the cardinal first, and then you got to speak to the bishop. There's nothing like that written down anywhere. It might, that I'm aware of, is there? How you communicate?
Well, I haven't talked to the Pope yet, so I don't know.
Well, what are you?
Well, in my spare time.
Oh, too. Okay.
Anyone is free to, you know, communicate with the Holy Father. Anybody can, you know, send a letter, make a phone call. I mean, maybe hanging, holding on the line a long time, I must face it, you know. He's a busy guy. But there's always that avenue of access to somebody.
Right.
There is. You have to jump through a few hoops, no doubt, to be sure you, you know, security and all such things.
Oh, yeah.
Make sure you're a person of good repute in that sense of the word, that you don't pose a threat or a risk.
Did the Holy Father go down and speak, bypass the cardinals, and just talk directly to the bishops? I mean, is that ever done?
It can be done.
But has it been done? See, this is what I'm saying, that I think that he needs to speak directly to the bishops, to the grunts, as we say in the military.
The
people that are doing the job.
I think a year or two, within recent history, there was a synod of bishops that met in Rome.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to think how far back it was, the synod of bishops, where all the bishops, those bishops who were present,
right.
met with them, and they had whatever dialogue and exchange took place right there.
Right.
So such exercises take place. The crux of the matter is who puts the agenda together?
Right.
And I mean by agenda, I don't mean we carry it, but who brings the agenda in terms of the subject matter?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Is it going to be the bishops writing ahead of time to go on what subject matter to be discussed? Or is it some bureaucrat?
Oh, yeah.
Well, in the Second Vatican Council, for example, I read this in the history of it. In the opening session, the bureaucrats in Rome had arranged everything. I mean, these guys, that's their job. They're bureaucrats. They do a good job.
Is the curia?
That's curia.
Yeah.
Curia, bureaucrat. They put together the agenda, the meeting, and whatever. And this is what we're going to be discussing. And I'm forgetting the name of
the... Does the Pope know, or does he suggest to them, this is what I want to talk about, this is what I want these people to hear, this is why I want them here, now go put it in order.
Well, it happened at that meeting, first meeting, that the one of the cardinal archbishops from Belgium
mm-hmm.
came time to speak.
Right.
And he made his speech. I forget the wording, I forget the gentleman's name right now. And when he made his comment, do we follow this routine, or to begin to speak as an ecumenical gathering of bishops.
Right.
And they just tore up the program and went from there.
Mm.
So it can happen where not just spontaneous so much as people bringing forth their concerns, their issues, which should we discuss. It can be done.
Right.
But you got to have somebody strong enough to say, excuse me, but I'm the boss here.
Right.
I think we need to do it this way.
Well, he's a Jesuit. I mean,
yeah,
they know how to be bosses.
That can be good. That can be very good.
They know how to be bosses.
Yeah.
So I mean, this almost comes natural to them. So what I'm saying is that now,
I think a lot of people are looking for someone that can take control, very transparently. Someone who says, hey, look, forget what's going on before. This is how it's going to be, and you got to come through me. These people said that he was a conservative. And some people said he's not a conservative, but he's very, well, we know on the social end, he's very liberal. And because he said, that's the teaching we're supposed to be following, and we're not doing it.
Mm-hmm.
So this is going to come to a shock to a lot of the people here in this country who don't want people to have even bread to eat.
Yeah.
So it's going to be a shock to a lot of them. So I want to see how they're going to react to it. But this Father Francis the First, and I want to, I said I was going to talk about that. My 4-year-old grandson,
mm-hmm.
outside our church here at Lady Constellation, we have a statue of Francis of Assisi. When my grandson came by the statue, he was 3 years old. My wife is, because he looked at it and he said, "Who's that?" And my wife told him who it was. So every time he comes to church, we leave church, he stops and says, "How are you, Francis? How's the bird? Did you feed the bird today?" Because there's a bird on his shoulder. And I picked him up from school yesterday. And the first words he said to me out of after school program, "Francis is the Pope." So it has, and he said it with such a wide smile on his face. It was almost like, it was like a happy birthday. So and I don't know what went on in school that day that could have generated this major interest, but maybe it's just because he has been speaking to the statue, says hello to it every time he comes to church. I don't know. But he was at the house last night, his mother's
right.
father, and that's all he taught me. He says, he is the first to.
Correct.
So we're going to see how this will affect a lot of young, which is where we need to set our focus on to get them involved in the church teachings. But how do you go about to get the younger generation involved? What do we have to do? What do you see, more involved, I should say, is a means that can lure more back?
If I had the answer for that, my,
you'd be close.
I'd write a book and I'd be rich. I think when I see young people growing up, and I'm edified to see them when they come to church and are present and participate in the worship, I see them on Sunday morning in their faith formation classes. And once in a while, I hear them talking with one another, and I hear comments like, "Where'd he or she learn that? Where'd they pick it up?"
Right.
It wasn't off the street.
Right.
Somewhere in their life, they've heard something that they felt they could own as their own, a teacher, a preacher, something about faith, religion, scripture that strikes home. And they feel like they can own that and make it part of their life. Now, part of growing up is to get away from church.
Right.
Okay. You know, I went to church, if I was 18 or 19 or 20, right through.
Right.
I didn't particularly care. I went.
You went.
I had to go.
Right.
Because I had to go.
Right.
It was my parents'
That's
faith
right.
in religion.
That's right.
When I moved to North Carolina, way back in the dark ages, went to Boone at Appalachian State. I started going to church. I was 22 years old, maybe. Well, then, the church became my church and my faith. Not my parents. It had to be mine.
You both see, what changed that, though?
I wanted it to be mine. Before that, it was my parents.
Well, what was the difference between the church that you went with your parents and then the church here? There had to be a change. I'll give you a for instance. I went to St. Gabriel was my church in East Elmhurst. I went to all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And when I came down here, I said, "Oh, we'll go to St. Gabriel's here." But I did not feel warmth. It was just stale, cold. I just didn't feel comfortable. I said, no. And then we went to Assumption, went to some other place.
Yes.
My cousin, first cousin, sang in a choir here. And she said, "Oh, you got to come to the Constellation." And I came here, but, I grew up Roman Catholic. There is no way that I could go and sit in the church with it talking and shouting and the band is playing I learned Latin. I mean, there's no way. I can't do that. I cannot do that. She says, oh, no, well, you got to go. She says, well, I don't know where. I said, I haven't found a church that I like. So Marilyn convinced me. It was one Christmas, and I came here and I heard, we went to Midnight Mass and choir.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And I said, you know, I like this, but that didn't do it. I came to a Saturday Mass.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt so comfortable,
mm-hmm.
and so warm and inviting. I said, you know, I love this. This is fabulous. So that was a change for me. But your change with your parents' church, as you say,
mm-hmm.
to where you owned the church in Boone, and that was the difference then. What was that difference that made you just say, you know, this is mine now?
The church community in Boone made the difference, with the exception of maybe one or two families.
Mm-hmm.
Well, everybody in the parish church, St. Elizabeth's Church in Boone, mm-hmm. at that time, and probably even now, they're all from out of state. Everybody who went to that church was from another part of the country, mm-hmm. or even the world.
Right.
And we had no real family there, but we made the parish to be our family. If I expected to survive, I needed to make friends.
Right.
Whether it be on the campus, or whether it be in my major department in discipline and geography, or even my faith community, I had to make friends.
Right.
And I wanted to make friends. So I set my mind, just by virtue of being present, to make acquaintances and friends with people in church. My very first Saturday Mass in Boone, I'm sitting there, a nice woman sitting next to me. A man reaches over and says, hi, my name is Phil Paul. This is my wife, Lorna. Welcome to St. Elizabeth's Church. I felt at home.
Mm.
I felt welcome.
Yeah.
There was maybe 50 people in the church at that
right.
time, maybe 60 at the most,
mm-hmm.
at that particular
right.
5 o'clock, 6 o'clock hour on Saturday. And I felt welcome. Somebody welcomed me. And I felt a part, and became a part of the community.
Right.
And
right.
I felt, what we see was an invitation to be present. And probably the fact that most of the people were going to be either college age, like myself,
mm-hmm.
or most, not all, but most, university affiliated,
right.
there was a certain commonality in that atmosphere.
Yeah, that's a university town, really.
University town. So there's a certain common denominator there.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt very much welcome there. I get back to the parish at home, which is very nice back in New Jersey.
Right.
And you're sitting in a church that can seat maybe 1,000 people.
Right, 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 right.
You know, and there's 4 masses on a weekend,
right.
5.
Right.
And here in Boone, there was maybe 2 masses if we were lucky.
Right.
And the church was not filled. It was a small place.
Right, right, right.
It was one was a sense of being welcome and adventure. Another one was, oh my gosh, I'm in a crowd of 1,000 people.
Right. Are my prayers being heard over these 1,000 people?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, people are pleasant.
Right.
I knew many of them because I grew
right.
up with the people there. But it was a very different atmosphere.
It was a homey atmosphere.
It was a homey atmosphere. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think a lot of college students and younger students, like you said, are looking for that homey atmosphere. I really think that is something that a lot of people look for. Because they want to feel like they're at home. When I was growing up, and we were told before, we had the Jesuits and the Bavarian brothers and the Sister St. Joseph, and we went to school. Everything was so strict. I mean, you did not talk. You didn't even cough in church.
As someone told me years ago, after spending 8 years in parochial school and 4 years in Catholic high school education, he was well prepared for the Marine Corps
boot. Yeah, absolutely.
He said that.
Yes.
This was a breeze compared to school.
That's right. Absolutely. I agree. I attest. It was the same thing with me. But the thing is, that now the grandkids there's one is 6 and the other one's 4, and they have to bring one of their toys with them in church. And I said, you know, how are they going to be paying attention to what is being said? And there was something you said at one of the masses.
Yeah.
And Blake, the little one, he was sitting next to me. He was playing his toy, and he stopped and says, why did he say that? So they are listening, even though they're doing other things, they hear. And I said to my wife, I said, you know, I thought he was playing, but he was actually listening. Because he asked me, and I can't remember, I wish I could remember it. It was something you said in your homily, because he said it to me after. And he said, why did he say that? And I said, you know, this is amazing. Because we were taught to, you know, you had to sit up straight, pay attention, don't look around, keep your eyes forward, you know, and so you could take in everything. Well, evidently not. So the change I have seen in the parents with their children coming to Mass is a major difference than when I was going to Mass. Major difference with kids. My two daughters, I used to talk to them before we went to Mass. I said, look, I don't want you talking. Don't be talking to me. You pay attention to every single thing that's going on. And they used to sit there, and they were so quiet. They didn't cry. This and they're 2 years old, 1 year old. They were perfect angels. And I was brought up under the strict teaching of you had to listen with 100% attention or you just didn't get it. So we have a Pope now, Francis I, who's evangelized all over Buenos Aires, and I am sure he is the person that can understand this more than most, since he has seen, I guess, every type of parish in Buenos Aires. But you remember what he said? He said that he is going to go into all the parishes in Rome. He said, Rome is my first agenda.
Well, he's a bishop. That's where he's the
bishop of Rome, right?
His people are in Rome, that's right.
So now, is that something that would be a big difference in past popes? Because if he's going to go to all the parishes in Rome and sit down and have dinner with them, I mean, that I don't remember any popes doing that. I mean, that's...
I haven't either, my
that's going to be was he has to come with his entourage.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure, yes.
Because they're not going to let him walk down the street to get on the bus, the city bus, like he did in Buenos Aires. I'm surprised they let him do that in Buenos Aires. But, so, there are going to be some limits to what he's going to do. Now, what do you think should be on the calendar for our new Pope? What do you think, say, if you had your pick of the top five things that he should... Or will we be looking at first?
I think he said the first one right there. First one should be, he's the Bishop of Rome.
Right.
And whether it's the city proper or the area around probably the rest of the diocese, that's his first responsibility to the people entrusted to him in his flock.
Is there a cardinal in Rome?
Yeah. No.
No?
No.
Oh.
But he's just the Bishop of Rome.
Oh, okay.
So take care of his flock.
Right.
Probably the next thing to do in terms of taking care of his flock is to exercise managerial skills over his bureaucracy.
Right.
This, it's my understanding of the Curia, the various bureaucracies that are there. It's not like a cabinet meeting every week.
Right.
I'm sure he could have an equivalent of a cabinet meeting every week and get all the leaders of all the different agencies together and say, or the leadership, I should say, and begin talking to them like a president does talk to his cabinet. And begin taking some, I use the word control, maybe begin taking the reins back.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want a micromanager.
Right.
That's not good.
Right, right.
You can be the micromanager to neglect.
Right.
And you want someone who can be able to jerk the reins periodically, make sure everybody's on point, and they take their responsibilities seriously with what they should be doing. So I'd say Bishop of Rome, and as well as look at his own bureaucracy there and take the reins on him. Another one I would say would probably say to look at the overall effort of evangelization. what it means to share the good news.
Right.
It was one day, according to the story, I heard this little vignette about Francis of Assisi. He got up in the morning, he asked one of the novices, let us go and preach the gospel today. So the novice followed from walk with Francis all over the city of Assisi. And if you've ever been there, if you aren't going uphill, you're going downhill to the side of a mountain. So they went all over the whole city. They walked around. They visited the marketplace and the streets. I had a chance myself to be there some years ago and realized this is where he ministered, in his own city.
Right out the streets.
And he finally get back to the friary, and the young novice said, well, when are we going to preach? So Francis said to him, he said, preach, I have to paraphrase what he said, preach everywhere, every day, but use words only when necessary. Because people learn not by words,
right,
but by example,
deed.
By deed.
Right.
That's how children learn.
Right.
Children, oh, who said this? Oh, gosh. Who was that author that wrote this? I saw it some time back. Children are great for not listening to their elders,
mm-hmm.
but they're great at imitating them.
Oh, yes.
I can't think of the author right
now.
And I know who it is.
Yes.
His picture is on the bulletin board over in the school right now.
Oh.
And it's embarrassing. At least I know what the word what
yeah,
it
absolutely.
Is.
Absolutely.
Children are like imitation.
Absolutely.
So outside of being bishop, taking the reins of the curia, his bureaucracy, and spreading the faith and teaching the faith, another one is to begin to look at his various relationships with all the bishops in the world,
mm-hmm.
to reaffirm their collegiality, because the bishops come together, they are in some degrees they're semi-autonomous. Each bishop really in the pecking order
right.
answers only to himself.
Right.
We know that. We see it happening right now in our own country. But to reestablish one another, to start working together, cooperating
mm-hmm.
together.
Mm-hmm.
I think the most recent example of the bishops trying to work together, we have a brand new prayer book at the altar. We call
right.
the Roman Missal.
Mm-hmm.
Well, some years ago, the American bishops worked on a new translation in American English for use in the American English-speaking American churches. They worked with various educated peoples, pulled this translation together, and they sent it to Rome for permission to use it.
Mm-hmm.
Then they could print it.
Right.
Well, the authorities in one of the bureaucracies took the missal and said, well, the copy, you know, their work, thank you very much. They put it on a shelf, and they told the American bishops and the English bishops and the Australian bishops, and anywhere English is spoken, we'll do one for you. Yet, bishops are the authentic translators of religion, of faith.
Mm-hmm.
The bishop is not a bureau.
Not the curia.
That's a curia. Our bishops are. There's one bishop for all the bishops together.
Mm-hmm.
They are the ones who are responsible for liturgy. Now, certainly, after you do your work, you want to be sure that it's all the I's
right.
are dotted and the T's and the T's across.
Right.
That's one thing. So that was taken away from them. That ability right there.
So that's the ability that they always had, or they should have had. So now they don't have that ability?
No. So the book we use now was done by a very good job. But those
yeah.
translators worked very hard. Not discredit.
Now, but is that because of power? They don't want them to have the power to do this, and the curia wants to maintain the power. And we're going to talk about the curia because I'm very curious about the curia. But it seems like it's about power, because what would be in the translation that the bishops that speak English around the world would want that the curia wouldn't want?
Well, you know, the last missal, the one we got in 1972,
right.
when we stopped using 2 years ago,
right.
well, that was a joint effort, not just amongst the Catholic bishops, but amongst other scholars as well.
Mm.
They took the Latin,
right.
the prayers already written in Latin, and they sat down with scholars from other denominations, and they hate to use those words, collaborated.
Yeah.
They collaborated on what the words were,
yeah.
on the prayers, I should say. And it was a very Catholic effort, but other denominations, Episcopalian, Methodist, United Church of Christ, these people were looking at the words and sharing, and there was dialogue going on, and realizing that some of the prayers that we have are being used in other churches,
right.
And horror of horrors, some of the prayers we use were ones coming from other denominations.
Yes. Yes.
Oh my gosh, I mean, that would send chills down from bureaucrat in Rome, as if God only speaks one language.
Right, well,
you know, Michael?
Right.
So, a lot has to do with power, probably fear that things will be watered down. I don't have that fear.
No,
you aren't going to make it. No, things are getting watered down.
No.
It has to do with power authority.
Absolutely. Now, but Bill, I didn't want to leave, but explain to us, what is the Curia?
The Curia is the government of Vatican City State.
Which consists of what?
It consists of the various agencies and various, the word is dicastery.
Because they're a country.
Well, it's a country, but it's also the church, too.
Right.
So whether it's the Secretary of State, or whether it's the office having to do with divine worship, or the office has to do with charitable efforts, all those are the bureaucracy of the Curia.
So now Pope Benedict was in charge of the, who you said the other day was
the Congregation for the Defense of the Faith.
Right. Now, he would have been part of the Curia that would have looked at this change of language, because he wasn't Pope then, I think. No. Would he have been a part of that?
Some other agency would have taken care of the translation, but people in his agency would make sure it's free of doctrinal errors.
Oh, right. Okay. So he'd be looking at the errors. He wouldn't be looking at the actual translation. He's responsible then. If he's the head, I mean, he's going to make the final decision.
That's right there, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So, we can owe our new missile to Pope Benedict.
Well, while he was, I forget the dates on these. There was a teaching document that came out of Rome. Mm-hmm. It's called English Translation, Authentic Liturgy. And it's a very wordy document. And it says in so many words that the translations should come directly from the Latin, because the prayers are written in Latin.
Right.
Well, that makes sense. You've got to translate into English. But that it should be strict adherence, not just the translation in Latin, but even things like grammar, syntax, and sentence structure.
Mm.
Well, there's no way you can translate literally from one language to another.
Right. Yeah.
There's always going to be some gray areas. But to take a sentence structure and syntax and the grammar and move it into English, it's very difficult.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is why you hear sometimes I trip over words. The language that we read in Mass to pray from orally,
right,
is really a great exercise to be read.
Right.
Wasn't translated to be proclaimed.
Right. Okay. Yeah, there's a difference between what you want to proclaim and what you just need to read. Yeah.
And so that, I mean, I look at that and realize this is meant to, and I read that after I realized this is an exercise in second year university Latin, how to translate from one language to the next.
Mm.
And I can remember doing that years ago myself, and my teacher said, very good, now what does it say in modern English? The English is translated, now what does that mean?
Right, what does it mean?
And I had to translate, think in a way of expressing it, the way we speak the language today. 4 years ago, the language we speak
today. When I was overseas in Vietnam, and I came back, I heard my first English Mass, and I said, where the heck am I at? What is going on here? The world's come to an end. I said, I can't do this. Well, I don't even know where I'm at here. And I'm reading these words. I said, well, I don't understand these words. Well, it's all English. There's no Latin. I can't follow it. I could not follow Mass for a year. And it didn't seem the same for some reason. Now, what you're talking about, the translation, what you proclaim and what you actually read are really two different things. And it also goes by how you say it, your inflection.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
You know? And so and people can have a different feel with the inflection that you give. Back to Pope Francis, he is the person who has spread the word. And that's why I believe he is going to be someone who's going to be on top of the communication end of it. Because I don't know if he is an office person, but if he was a pastor, he is an office person. Because you just got a big office. You just got a bigger pastoral area to cover. You got to cover the world now. Yeah. I mean, so they said, well, you need somebody who's a mathematician that can do the computer, that can do all this other stuff. Well, what do you feel about that? Is that something that is you at this point is necessary, or is the getting out and spreading the word, the good news, more important than making sure the inside game is working? We're looking at it was so much of this. Well, we need someone to come in and clean up, and that's what I said. I said I thought.
Yeah,
Pope Benedict.
I remember that you said that.
Hey, you know, he wanted this thing cleaned up, and he couldn't do it with himself sitting there. So he's going to blow this thing up. And I know the people who are going to be affected by this are running scared, for their jobs. I mean, this man does the new Pope don't even want to use the limousine. I mean, where do you get the load of that $750,000 bill for the nativity? I mean, he's going to say, what, are you kidding me for a straw? He is a preacher who wants to go out and spread the good news, and he seems to be a touchy-feely person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He wants to get out and touch the people and give them that good feeling. He is not a standoffish and let somebody else do that. But he's going to have to do that. But he's going to, as you said before, he's going to have to bring in the rain because a lot of this has been so exploded, so blown up, that I'm sure it can be shrunk down where it's more manageable.
Mm-hmm.
And you shouldn't get an accounting file on your desk that you say, what? I mean, that is going to be, I think after the first month or so, we should start seeing a change in something. So now, as I get back to when they come home, do you think they'll be bringing back any messages from what is going on? Will have anything? The bishop sent a message to all the pastors. This is what we heard from the Holy Father.
I suspect whatever they hear, they share. It'll be talked about in the news, maybe some newspaper articles, journal articles may be there. Their own experiences there.
Right.
But following what you're saying, my advice, if he asked me for my advice, the first 4 points, and my fifth point would say, Holy Father, please stay home and mind the store.
Yes.
Your employees are running amok.
Running amok.
All right. And when you get them lined up, then fly somewhere and visit people.
Right.
You know, he had 25 years of John Paul II.
Right.
Great personality. Very people-oriented, very, very outward, very gregarious. He didn't stay home and mind the shop.
Yeah, he was gone.
He was gone.
Gone all the time.
And one way, that's good. You know, he visited
around the world. He was there.
All over the world. Benedict, a little travel, not much, but some travel. But he certainly retired to his study. He's an academician, in every good sense of academician.
Right.
He's a man of letters, a man of words,
right.
And to be respected for that.
Right.
So he has
not a manager.
Not I would say, from what I can ascertain, not a manager. So he had maybe 30 years of my terminology.
Not watching the store.
No one's watching the store. Hands off on the store.
Right.
Now it's time about hands on again. Mm. And you know, and I know from experience, when the new boss comes in to manage the shop, the next level of management goes ballistic.
Yes.
And then the next level goes ballistic after that.
Right.
Because
right.
Now the boss is in.
Right.
And he's going to watch what they're doing.
Oh, now they got two bosses there. Boss one and boss two. I mean, maybe they needed a team.
Sure.
He said, look, I'll be here to back you up.
Yeah.
I'm only about 5 miles away, wherever it is, 95 miles away.
But just a thought on that, our president now, can turn around and speak to some predecessors.
Right.
Right. Absolutely correct.
And seek their advice. And that's what they do. I've heard this in the news.
Yes.
They talk to one another.
Yes.
Well, here we have a new pontiff who can turn around and go to his predecessors
right.
and what's going on with this.
That's right.
What was your experience
Absolutely.
Here? And that's not bad.
No,
that's
it is.
Not bad.
It
that's,
is.
That's good. As long as the other guy doesn't say how to do it.
Yeah.
And he shouldn't. You should just say, this is my experience.
Right.
This is what I did.
Right.
It's your ball game now.
Well, he's not one of the people that Benedict appointed as a cardinal. He was already a cardinal.
Well, that's right. John
that's right.
Paul
you see, because, right.
Yeah.
Because he came in second in the running, supposedly.
That's what I heard.
Benedict, yes. Yeah. So he doesn't have that thumb on him where he said, look, hey, I got you the job. He already had the job. You see?
He's not Benedict's lapdog.
That's right. He's not Benedict's lapdog.
That's right.
But I think this is something good that they're both there. I think it's something good. And that was, you're talking about the loneliest job. They showed the picture of Kennedy looking out the window. They always saw that famous picture of Kennedy in black and white where he's looking out the window. It's the loneliest job in the world. Well, he now has someone close by here on Earth that he can talk to and get a verbal answer from. He
sat in that chair.
That's right, sat in that chair.
He knows what it
is. There's nobody that, this is the first time in what, 1,300 years. And back then, we don't know if he spoke to the other, but we don't know where the other one went. Did he go to a convent? A monastery somewhere? Yeah, he went to
a monastery.
Yeah, so he wasn't close by, he couldn't speak to him. So here, so that's why I think together, him relying on Benedict about what failed and what didn't happen, I think is very, very good. But he definitely, as you said, has to be able to clean up the bureaucracy. And not only the bureaucracy in Imperio, but around the world. We have here this diocesan. How many diocesan priests do we have in Charlotte?
I'm going to say maybe 90 to 180.
Oh, really?
Does that mean? Maybe 80.
Okay.
Yeah, something like that.
And they answer to the bishop?
Directly to the bishop, yeah.
Directly to the bishop. So there are things that each diocesan, that each priest in their parish needs to get guidance from the bishop. But how does that work when you're a pastor in your own church? You actually run the church. You're not saying, well, I'll recall the bishop and see what he says I can do with this or what I can do with this. How does that run? I mean, you're actually the CEO of the church.
When we get the keys of the church, so to speak,
yes,
and we run the place, we trust that we're going to manage the place, administer the place, pastoral care of the local parish, according to what we were taught to do.
Right.
According to what, we'll say, the written guidelines call for.
Right.
Sometimes a situation may come up where I'm needing advice. It's not for him directly. It might come from somebody at another level in his bureaucracy
right.
down on Church Street.
Right.
Church Street. What I need to look at, something Andy, for example, in business of finance,
mm-hmm.
I wouldn't call the bishop, I'd call the CEO.
Right.
Okay. Or his business office. And say, gee,
right.
I got a situation. I have a check here going for building fund, and we need to go over here. What do I do with this?
Mm-hmm.
He'd say, policy is this. And so I would seek out policy, for example. Since I have a good record to the bishop, he in turn would refer me
right.
to the people
right.
he has advising him
mm-hmm.
on business and finance in one area there. So, yeah, we're pretty well expected to manage the place. If things would get too much, then we turn and seek advice.
Right.
If it's beyond, how we used to say, beyond my pay grade.
Well, this is really how the curio is run. Same way, I would assume. Is that correct?
It's supposed to be there to facilitate the church in the world.
Right. Okay.
Facilitate the church in the world.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's meant to be there for all the good that can be done. But like any, universities have publisher parish. Many universities and colleges, either you publish or you parish for the faculty.
Right.
And considering the amount of paperwork that comes out of the curia in Rome, I think maybe the officials take it to heart if they don't publish something, they can lose their job.
Yeah.
I don't think it'll be that simple.
Yeah, right.
But
right,
yeah.
Right. Well, getting back to here, A Lady Consolation, What do you see happening as far as what is your vision for the next year or so that you'd like to see happen?
Dear Our Lady Consolation, the parish continues to go on its path of a growing faith community.
Mm-hmm.
We are a growing faith community. That people continue to find this as a place to call their parish home. And that we, in turn, as a local parish, find ways and increase our ways of, I'll use the word, of involvement and outreach into the local community here.
And we have about, I don't know how many.
Oh, gosh.
No, 21.
More than that.
Is it more than that?
We have about 35, 40, 50 ministries.
Oh. Well, that's we're going to start. I'm going to start having a ministry on the show. We're going to bring it up at our next parish council meeting.
Yes,
I'm going to start. I'm going to ask them who's going to step up to be the first one to interview. We'll have one once a week, so they can get the word out, evangelize right over the air.
That's great.
And I think that we now at this church, with the large population that will be coming in with the new renovations of housing around here and the expansion of the streets outside and the things that we have in mind about how to change the campus, I think will be a major step in the right direction to making Lady Consolation a larger member in this community and in this city. And I think they're going to be hearing more and more of Lady Consolation as time goes on.
I suspect so, and I hope so, Michael.
Well, I want to thank you.
My pleasure.
And let's see what Pope Francis the First does.
Mm-hmm.
Let's give him about 5 months and see
if he
scream uncle and say, what have you got me into? he's got a friend. He's got Pope Benedict here. So they can commiserate together.
Right.
Okay, this is the last word, and this is the end of part two of our conversation with Father Carl from Our Lady of Consolation in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Okay, I want to tell you, that was very nice.
It was very nice to be here, too.
And as we say, in Rome, do as the Romans do. Well, there's a new sheriff in town, and his name is Pope Francis the First.
Very first.
Who was born and baptized as Sister Giovanni Francisco de Pietro di Verdone.
I'm not sure.
Does that sound good? October 3rd, 1226. An Italian Catholic friar and preacher. He founded the Men's Franciscan Order and the Women's Order of St. Clare. And the Third Order of St. Francis for men and women not able to live the lives of
itinerant preachers. By the way, just
preacher.
A clarification.
Yes?
Due note to these lovely people, we're talking about St. Francis himself, who the current Pope has taken his name in honor of.
That's correct.
Because this is the original Francis from the 12th century.
That's correct. And what was your...
I just want to make sure, because we're not talking about, Jorge. We're talking about...
We're not talking about Sinatra either.
Yeah, the original St. Francis. So, one of the great things about St. Francis is that... He is one of the most beloved saints.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And according to what I was reading here about St. Francis, where did I see that? Francis, St. Francis. Oh, St. Francis loved preaching to ordinary people. And since he had no license to do so, evidently he had to have a license back then. In 1209, he composed a simple rule for his followers, the friars, which came from a verse in the Bible. The rule was to follow the teachings of our Lord Jesus Christ and to walk in his footsteps. These people at CPAC, I guess they haven't read that.
They didn't get that part of the gospel.
Mm-hmm. In 1209, Francis led his first 11 followers to Rome to seek permission from Pope Innocent III to found a new religious order. Upon entry to Rome, the brothers encouraged Bishop Gordio of Assisi, who had in his company Giovanni di San Pablo, the cardinal bishop of Sabina. The cardinal, who was the first confessor of Pope Innocent III, was immediately sympathetic to Francis and agreed to represent Francis to the Pope. Reluctantly, Pope Innocent agreed to meet with Francis and the brothers the next day. After several days, the Pope agreed to admit the group informally. So that's where it all started from.
Yeah, one of the things I thought was really fascinating reading this biography was that it says that when he made his pilgrimage to Rome,
mm-hmm.
because, you know, back then Rome was the, as it is now, I guess, the capital of the Christian movement.
Right.
But when he made his pilgrimage there, it said that he joined in the poor because he was astonished to see all the poor in the city. And he joined them in begging around St. Peter's Basilica.
Mm-hmm.
And that experience is what led him to then, from that moment on, he led his entire life in poverty. And he even founded that order, which was the Order of the Poor. But that became the hallmark, you know, of his faith, his living in poverty and in a Christ-like manner. But I think that's very, very interesting, especially today, you know, with his, all you ever see is the, you know, the golden thrones and the gigantic cathedrals to the sky. It's going to be a really interesting new pope that we have here.
Yeah, well, where do you get the load of that bill for the $750,000 for the nativity scene at Vatican City? Give me a break.
$750,000?
To put out the nativity scene every year. I mean, what, are you kidding me?
Can they reuse their statues or something?
I don't know.
Maybe they're hand painted with the tears of.
Give me statues. They must be using real people.
I'm telling you.
They must be getting sad wages.
I think where the three wise men show up, they have real jewels.
Unless they fly the three wise men in.
Yeah, but then
yeah,
we still have, you know, $650,000.
Give me a break.
Wow, that's pretty amazing.
Well,
So do you think we're going to have a profound transition here?
I think, I said this at the last interview.
You are the Catholic at the table here, so I'm picking your brain.
I said this at the last interview with Father Mike, our first part one. I said, I believe when, Pope Benedict, and I can't remember the three letters, he was in charge of the documents to make sure that everything in our teachings is correct. And they changed the name. It used to be the what's the thing that they had? What's the main thing that they did back then?
The Inquisition.
They changed the name of what Pope Benedict did.
Okay.
It used to be the Inquisition. Now he's the keeper of the documents. I forgot, it was three letters Father Carl said, and I should remember them, but. So He's going to make sure that what is in the documents is actually the interpretation. Now, the thing is, the main thing with St. Francis was, St. Francis, I mean, and we're going to compare him to the Pope here, he had opulent, he had a fabulous place to live with bungalow, with a carte blanche on the cars and transportation. He took the bus, city bus everywhere, went to visit all the people in the parish, had dinner with them. In Buenos Aires, he went to a hospital that took care of HIV patients and washed all their feet. This man is a man of the people, and he did not like it when one priest in just escaped me right now, where in, because he was the Archbishop of Buenos Aires, where in Buenos Aires this happened, but a one priest refused to baptize a child because the child's mother didn't have mother and father. They had, there were two women that were living together for years, and they had an adopted child. So he refused to baptize them. When he found out about it, he went ballistic. He called the priest and said, get that child baptized. I don't care what the parents are. So he is going to follow the teachings to get everybody baptized, and that's going to cut wrong against the grain of these so-called holier than thou, Rick Santorum, and Rubio and Ryan, because they don't believe, they believe in excommunication.
Right.
So, you know, we will see.
Well,
but he is not going to go in that. Supposedly, he's strict, conservatively speaking, on other things, like gay marriage and abortion, but that remains to be seen.
Right.
Because he was only in Latin America. Now he has 1.2, 1.3 billion souls a day.
Right.
So let's see how that works. Now, I also understand there was a lot more in Latin America, people leaving the church and going to this conservative evangelical religion. So they were losing a lot to that, because they have gone strictly, so strict, it's almost like in something insane.
Yeah.
They are really...
in the last 10, 20 years, the evangelical sphere started really, really, you know, with all the 700 club idea.
Right.
They started worldwide evangelical, you know, not doing the Billy Graham evangelical thing where he just goes out and preaches to people, but going out and trying to actively convert.
Right.
And bring in, of course, lots of money.
Right. But that's the bottom line.
A huge movement in Africa and South America and all that.
It's about money. It's not about the religion.
Yeah,
and when these people find out about it, the Lord needs to protect those people. I'm going to tell you right now.
Well, you know, they're trying to, you know, you remember we had that discussion last year about the these evangelicals and Republicans united down in Uganda or wherever.
Right. Oh, yeah.
Killing all gays or whatever.
Castrating the women.
Yeah, that, you know, that type of stuff is just insane. But that's kind of what those activists are doing. You're talking ultra-conservative, you know. But here, I just wanted to read this one thing to you.
Yeah.
Because you mentioned the Christmas thing. This might not bode well. Just saying.
Yeah.
It says that... one thing that St. Francis of Assisi is known for is that in 1223, he arranged and created the first Christmas manger scene ever in the church, and it became standard thereafter.
No.
So,
750,000. Yeah, right. Okay, and right now we have phone with us hello, there, caller. We have right now Joseph Wardell, who is on the Board of Education and our third district representative. Miss Rochelle, how are you?
I'm doing great. Just wonderful. It's wonderful to hear from you. And I was listening to the previous conversation about religion and about St. Francis of Assisi was the first one to put up the manger scene. So
right.
This is very informational to me.
Oh, yeah. Well, we just, I just did an interview with, I don't know if you've met Father Carl yet. He's the new pastor of Our Lady of Consolation Church, which is my church. And I just did a two-part interview with him on the conclave. And last week and this week, I just played it. But we were talking about that because on one side of the church, when you walk into the church, there's a 4.5-foot statue of St. Francis of Assisi. And it's so funny because, as I was saying in the tape, one of my grandsons, well, both of them, they speak to the statue every time they go to church on Saturday. They speak to the statue. How are you, St. Francis? How are you? This and that. And they talk to him. And because he also was the one who was the protector of the animals, So the thing was that when I saw him the other day, my youngest one, he has such a huge smile on his face. He said, St. Francis is now the Pope. So it's almost like he knows him because he thinks the person is alive because of the statue. So it's really funny. But but there's a lot of things, and I'm going to put all this information about St. Francis on our website.
Yeah.
But
historic moment.
Right, it is a historic moment. What is the story with the Board of Education? You have a new superintendent, am I correct?
He's new, but now he's been here almost a year.
And what has been the difference? Have you seen a difference?
We've seen a lot.
One
thing, as you know, he's done a lot of community meetings. He's involved the total public and 22 focus groups. So there's something for everybody who's interested in education to make a contribution to what goes on in the Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools. The schools belong to all of us, and I think everyone, every citizen, should take an invested interest in what's going on. We must be an educated society. And as an educated society, we all are making contributions. Many times when big businesses want to come to Charlotte, the first thing they start looking at is the schools. When they start looking for a relocation perk, they want to know what kind of school system we have, how many students are we graduating, what are some of the course offerings. And to say, surely Charlotte-Mecklenburg is one of the very best school systems in the country. Of course, you know now we were the recipient of the Broad Prize, which is given to the best urban district in the United States. So we continue.
Oh, you know that?
Yes.
When did this happen?
That happened in 2011. So we continue to do great things in education. Now, you were concerned about sequestration and how it would affect.
Right.
You know, CMS receives the bulk of its funding from state and local dollars. Now, sequestration refers to federal dollars. However, federal dollars is a small percentage, 15 to 20% of what we receive, but it's a very important percent. So we are following those developments in Washington, D.C. closely. And as soon as we know more things, we will be able to share those things with the public and with our employees. So for right now, it will not affect this year, but perhaps next year. And let me tell you about exactly what many people don't know what it is. You know, we have frightening information from time to time from our federal level. So it gives us an opportunity to look forward, to be visionaries, and to watch what's going on, and to communicate with our representatives in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
As they make decisions, as they look at what's best for this state and for this county. And so on Thursday before the Senate Appropriations Committee on what could happen to the education programs if Congress takes no steps to avert a March 1 deadline for automatic spending cuts known as sequestration. So that's no more than the spending cuts. And so our Secretary of Education, Arne Duncan, really says that the across-the-board nature of these cuts would focus a reduction in many of the things that we do for and we receive federal funds for all of the children. And really it affects many of our most needy children because it will cut those federal funds that provide, that support the programs that many of them participate in. And we're thinking, well, sequestration with this budget cut, not only will it affect education, it's going to affect everything across the board when it comes to federal dollars.
Well, isn't the lunch program, low cost, some is little cost, and then there's some free, that sequestration would affect that tremendously, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. It's going to affect everything when it comes to federal money. And it's that term that's used to describe the practice of using mandatory cuts in the federal budget. Mandatory cuts in the federal budget. And I guess you've heard about the reduction in the tours for the White House.
Yeah, well.
That's part of it, too. So it really calls attention to the fact that when you cut federal dollars, it impacts all of us. It impacts education. It impacts everything that federal money is used for.
Well, you know, the thing is, though, that got me upset is that they were making such a big deal about not being able to go to the White House. Who cares? That's nonsense. You can go to the White House anytime. The problem is that these senators and these congressmen use that tour of the White House as a give-me for the people who are voting for them. I mean, you know, who cares if we can't get the White House this year? Maybe we'll go 2 years from now. But you don't have to. But kids need lunch in school.
Yes, they do. And education of the White House and those tours are a valuable part of education programs for many students because they had that in their curriculum before and they had a part of it that they would visit the White House. They know what's going on in their federal government. And
right.
The people who represent us, they would have an opportunity to see them. And it would be much more of an impact than just viewing the bricks and mortar, just viewing the interior features, but an education that lets you know what happens here in this place as it affects the laws that govern us. So as we think about across the board cuts and some of the things that we will see from sequestration that we don't want to see, for example, many school districts that qualify for impact aid, that would be cut. For many children, homeless children that get Title I funds, you know, a lot of Title I funds used for lunch, used for children who for some reason are needy and need more educational opportunities.
Right.
Title I labs in reading and math. To help them to grow, to help them to be proficient, and to help them to be good learners in the school.
Right.
Districts will have to plan on less funding. That will be fewer teachers and staff, could mean larger classrooms, and fewer courses in certain subject areas for many of our struggling students. And for many of them, here in Charlotte-Mecklenburg, we have what you call a staff-teacher ratio, and for many of our schools, we have given them a smaller pupil ratio for many of our struggling schools so that teachers will have fewer students in the classroom and can spend more time with their students and not have a classroom of 40, but maybe a classroom of 21. So it will eliminate that. And then we have grants. Funds that we can apply for.
Right.
So as we think about sequestration, it would even delete a lot of those. In particular, counselor class loads would likely increase. So we have a lot of things that we will be affected by, but we're looking at 2013-2014 school year. So it really gives us time start thinking ahead and start thinking about what we need to do. And even though the cuts may not be as severe as we think, we just don't know right now. But we need to plan ahead and make provisions for it in case it happens.
Well, you know, one thing I always wondered was, why don't they have in school a section for maybe just a term on, like I have when I went to school, learning about civics.
When I was teaching, they didn't have a civics class
that was a term long. It might have been like 3 or 4 weeks, but it wasn't the whole term.
You know what? We're becoming more of an educated society than we've ever been before.
Mm-hmm.
And our wave, national trend, and as we prepare students for the future, many of the programs that we had 5 years ago will be obsolete.
Mm-hmm.
We're looking more than math,
yes,
technology, and they're replacing a lot of things that a lot of the other learnings that we have. So as we think about our federal dollars, Title I grants to local education agencies serve maybe 23 million students in high-poverty schools, and then we have the special education grants that provide public schools special education needs for students. Many students come to us and they have needs. Some are developmental, some are special needs as a result of things that happen to them physically or mentally. And they have to be taken care of. Any student that walks through that door, the schoolhouse door, we must serve that student because we are a public education agency. Not only that, sequestration would reduce Title I funding, as we think about the whole nation, by some $725 million, and that would probably eliminate an estimated 270,000 schools serving 125 million disadvantaged students. Not only would it affect the students, it will also affect the jobs of the teachers who serve these students. So that formula grants to the state under Part B of the Individual with Disabilities Education Act would be reduced by as much as $598 million, and that would require states and districts to cover the cost of those teachers that serve those students. So that's the fear that we have. And
hopefully, before you go on, how does that affect charter schools? Because some of these places now,
charter schools are public schools.
Okay, but you see,
they're public schools too.
Okay, but they're not being used like that across the nation.
No, in Charlotte, in Mecklenburg County, the charter schools, the CMS Board of Education, we must give them the same dollars to operate their public schools just as any other, our traditional public schools. But the state has granted them a charter to operate in regards to the contract that they've written up. But that, but they can serve the population that they have written their charter for and the population that they deem necessary as a result of their educational program. For us in the public schools, we must serve every child.
Okay.
When children
That's not the case in a lot of states across the country. They're using charter schools to reauthorize segregation in a lot of places.
It cannot be for that stated purpose, but as the charter is written, it will serve. They have designated the kind of students out of category of students that they want to serve, but it cannot be used to segregate anybody. When it comes to public accommodations under the Civil Rights Act, that cannot happen.
Well, no, you're absolutely right. But what I'm saying is a lot of these school systems use the charter schools, and when there's a misbehaved child, they send that child to the charter school. And the thing is that what is happening across the country, you see more and more minorities in
certain charter schools and more white population in charter schools trying to get away from the minorities.
As we look
That's not the same case in Charlotte, in Mecklenburg County, but, you know, what it says, if I want, I'm only taking kids that are left-handed and they might, I mean, and they're okay in it, you know, there's something wrong with this picture here.
Yeah, but it cannot be used for discriminatory purposes as a charter. It can be designated for a certain educational purpose, educational category.
Right, right.
Students.
That's what it was supposed to be used for. But, all right, so they get the same amount of money, how is it determined how much money a charter school gets versus a public,
Proportionately, they will get the same amount of money per pupil as in the traditional school. Their charter comes from the state, not from CMS. And we don't even govern them. You know, at one time, until 2 years ago, there was a cap on charters, 100 for 100 schools. And as time began to change the last year, that cap was lifted. And as they lifted the cap, then more people could apply for charters. And as a result, then we see a lot more charters. We as a public school do not monitor them and monitor what they do.
Have you seen a decrease in the pupil attendance of the public schools since the increase in charters?
Not really, because we still have more students every year than we've had. We still have an increase in student populations. Right now, the total of students enrolled in CMS is like 144,000. And those pre-kindergarten, we have 2,734. Grade 6 to 8, we have 31,000. 20, 9, 12, 38,000. Self-contained exception of children, 2,529. And this is where we will see cuts if that sequestration takes place in those self-contained exception of children's classes, because we get a lot of federal dollars for that, for the education of those children. But we are watching this very closely, and we are staying in contact and asking the citizens, stay in contact with your congressman, because this is federal. This is what's going to be coming from Washington as a result of the laws, the legislation that will be passed there.
And Mrs. Waddell.
Yes.
Hi. There's a question for you directly related to that. Because I have children in CMS, and, you know, we just went through depression, but recession that cost everybody quite a bit. And we saw everything from, you know, libraries losing days and closing locations to schools being put on hold, so to speak, the ones that were supposed to be coming online. And so that affects everyone. And then now we have a kind of manufactured recession coming with the sequestration. Just today we're hearing news about trying to move forward and go to all digital textbooks and get much-needed training for teachers in all kinds of new technologies. So what can common citizens like us do to help y'all out and get as much pushback as we can to do everything we can to save our children's schools and advance them, not just keep the status quo?
You know, one of the things that citizens can do, we have the 22 task forces. I don't know if you wanted to be a part of them, but the meetings are open, and they're listed on the website, and they're listed as their meeting places and meeting times, so that anybody in this county can attend task force that are of interest to them. And our superintendent has been very transparent, very open about going to different parts of the county, holding meetings, asking people about budgets. So we have that's what we can do, get involved. Every citizen can be involved. And then if those are not convenient for you, get a group of people who have a concern and ask your school board representative to come out and talk to you. We're available and we can do that. So we must we must give the public information that's accurate, arm them with things that they can do, and sit down and talk for yourself. If you get five other people and you come together and say, Joyce, I want you to come and talk to us, and we want to ask in-depth questions, I'd be happy to do it. We have a large board members. I don't know who your district person is, and they will also do the same thing. We'll talk to you individually. We'll talk to you in small groups, and we'll talk to you in large groups. So stay involved, and most of all, we have concerns. We have public comments the second Tuesday of each month. Come down with the public comments and share your thoughts. You can talk about any subject that is of interest to you. And you talk to the entire board. You'll be talking to all the listeners and viewers because they will hear your concern. So that's another thing that you can do. That may be one of the most important things that you can do. Come down on Tuesday and share your thoughts, share your ideas.
Has anything been rattled around about instead of building schools one story high or two stories high, build them four or five stories high so you get more kids in and get rid of those trailers?
There is some conversations going on there. There is some conversations going on with them, the high-rise buildings. And that's one of the things that you're concerned about. Bring me two other people, and let's have a discussion on it. And let me
come out and
talk to you about it. Also, come down the second Tuesday and talk to us about it. Just do a little bit of research on it and let us know why that's advantageous.
Well, you know, and I'll tell you, I'm from a big city, New York City. We got, I know one school that's 12 stories high. And matter of fact, my elementary school was 8 stories high. That was my Catholic elementary school. And I asked, when I first moved down here, I asked this question of a board member, and I just cannot, well, I do remember, I'm not going to say who it is, but you know him. And it was back in 93. I said, why don't they have schools instead of 5, 6, 7, 8 stories high? He said, they're worrying about the kids getting caught in fire. I said, that is was the most stupidest answer I've ever heard. Our kids are so dumb. These kids in this school, they couldn't get out of the school.
That may be a wave of the future when land scarcity continues, when we don't have enough land to build and to build spread out schools like we're building them now. So I think you may see some of that in the future.
Well, you know, but you're right when you say it that way, but that wasn't how the question was asked, because I said, we got these trailers. Build the schools up higher. And they said, oh, no, we have an ordinance against that because of fire. Now, that was the answer I got. See, your answer is powerful. I understand that, because we have a lot of space. But not the answer that we're afraid that the kids will get burnt up in a fire and we can't build up higher.
It's probably efficiency and movement is the reason that those plans are the way they are. And I would think there's efficiency in movement, student movement. And because we have the space and the architecture design is there. And it goes through a lot of research, not just one group of people.
Right.
But a national and a state design. And sometimes that's a good question that you can come down and ask your people together, and you want me to get the people that are responsible for it, that they can ask in-depth questions, that you can ask in-depth questions, and they will have research that backs it up. That would be great. And now you ask me about that, that's something I will find out for you and get back to you.
Here's the thing, that, you know, why do we have the trailers? If we have the rooms, why aren't the school being built big enough for the trailers?
So well, one of the reasons far as the population growth, we can't control where people live. We can't control where developers tend to build developments. Right. And when mm-hmm. they build developments in certain areas, then they're going to need new schools and more schools. When industries move, they move in certain geographical locations. And when mm-hmm. they do that, they tend to create a population that's going to be working there, and that will change your patterns. So you need more schools in that area. For a long time, the north and end of the county did not develop. And one of the basic reasons was because of the infrastructure. It was hard to get sewer lines up there. Had a lot of land that didn't perk. As time went on, they were able to find ways to develop that infrastructure, and building began to boom. And so as you plan for, you need to be planning sometimes like 10 years ahead.
Oh, yes.
You have to have money to do that with, because dollars must go with your construction. And as you plan for and look at development, look at land and look at developers that may want to come and build housing. You know, we have about 1,000 people moving to Charlotte every month, moming into Metropolitan mm-hmm. County from wherever. I didn't say how many we have leaving, but we have about that number, 1,000 moving mm-hmm. here.
Right.
So this is a very desirable place, and many of them bring children, and children have to be educated. Children go to school. When we had the big boom with employment and a lot of building, it brought a lot of people from out of town. It brought a lot of people from across the border. They have to be educated. They got to go to school. We must have an educated society. Now, if you think about mm-hmm. it, in 1950, we had maybe only half of the entire population in the United States had finished high school, which is very different today. Almost
right.
any profession, any job that you want to go in, you must have a high school diploma, and that diploma must mean something. So I want to thank you for having me.
Well, it was wonderful. See, you gave a very good answer. I would have walked away in 93 with an answer that you gave, that answer that you just gave me, satisfied.
I'll stay tuned to you and keep up with the good work that you're doing.
Well, we want to get the
radio program, because you're doing great work in this community, and you've always done great work. So I applaud you for what you do, and I applaud you for keeping the public informed. And not only the listening audience, because they need public radio. And I remember when I grew up, radio was the thing that we had. We didn't have television in every home. And I was in about seventh grade before we ever had a television. We listened to the radio. And I listened to it every day. So radio is coming back, because it gives a kind of communication that's lost, a kind of communication that we need. And so thank you for all you do. And I'll talk to you again.
I want to thank you very much. And we'll have you back.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye. Bye-bye.
That was the 3rd District Board of Education member, Joyce Waddell. They have a school here that's named after her husband.
That's correct.
That's right.
And you heard it. Please get involved. You have any questions? You want to know anything? You want to change?
That will tell me. It was an architect who told me this.
Yeah, yeah.
He said, we can't because fire.
Fire!
I said, are you kidding me? I said my elementary school was bigger than every high school down here, except for maybe, I don't know if the Catholic school might be 8 stories high. I think that's 8 stories high or higher. But no, the public schools, any public schools 8 stories high? I don't think so. That's completely ludicrous. And then they build this thing, we got a lot of land out of building school, and within that year, they got 10 trailers in the parking lot.
Yep.
You have no more parking lot.
Well, you know, there was an interesting thing happened over here in school near you. My child was in the school, and when he finished that school, went to a new school, but that year, they closed it down and built a new one
right
beside it. The new, and it actually is two-story. Ooh.
Yeah.
But we were excited. We were neat. So we went up, and we knew the principal and everything, went up toward it and saw it. And I said, oh, nice. You know, you built a new school when my son's leaving. Appreciate that. Joking around. But anyway, went in there. Well, same thing happened. When they opened, they had to leave 2 entire grades at the old school because there wasn't enough space. And I said, what the heck? Are you building a school where you can't even put... And the reason was, and this is what they told me, and this is kind of sad to show you how bureaucracy worked, but they were working off of a bond that had been passed almost like 10, 20 years before on a projected population growth. And it was a school of X number, and they had far exceeded that now. So on opening, it was over capacity, and they had to leave two entire grades at the Oldfield School and reopen it. So that tells you right there.
Yeah, because that was supposed to be the new library.
Yes.
That's why that whole thing happened,
and they ended up...
So we had built the library.
Right. That's why that took years later. Now, but you see the headache. They do have, you know, built-in problems trying to project things, you know, schools and all buildings. Because, you know, like out where I am now in a whole different district, they have a lot of growth. So they have an entire line of schools on a schedule that they're going out about 30 years. They're building is one after the other.
And it's still going to
grow. Elementary, junior high,
high school. Because the same moron just scheduled this.
By the time they're open, there'll be in time to build a line of trailers right behind them. Yeah.
I mean, just give me a freaking break.
So to your point, why not build it? Like, if you think you're going to have 10,000 students, build it for 50. Just saying. Just in case there's more.
They not leave it.
You know? And then maybe you could use that extra space for, I don't know, activities again. Remember when we were growing up, they had art, chorus, you know, they had sports. You remember all those things?
You had gym.
Now they have
a gym.
Well, now they have every school here. It cracks me up. Every school has one big room. And the one big room is gym, art, chorus, cafeteria, storage room, and everything else all at once.
I mean, in our big library that we had, big library.
Oh, those are things.
And I'm talking about in the 50s, we had a huge library, just a high school. And one part of the library was like a studio. It was about, I'd say, 15 feet wide by 30 feet long or 40 feet long. And in that library, on the walls, there were shelves and shelves and rows of 33 and a third records of music, movies, and headphones. You could sit down during your lunch break, and if you had a pass, you could go there and sit and listen to music or show tunes or anything like that. They don't have that today.
One multi-purpose room that they don't get to do anything in because they're rotating them through in 15-minute shifts. You know.
My school, Wingate High School, which is they now have split it down to two schools, represented United States schools at the 1956 Brussels World's Fair. It was built in 56 or 54, so I can't remember. But it represented the U.S. schools. It was the first all glass and steel school. It was banjo shaped and had a round portion that was 1, 2, 3 stories high, and what they call the arch, which was the long portion of the banjo that was 2 stories high. But we had 2,200 kids, which will swamp most schools here.
Yeah, right there, you've already exceeded the entire CMS.
They got trailers in New York now, some trailers. They can't grow anymore. There's no more land.
Right. I mean, when you're talking about, you know,
Manhattan. Yeah, but here.
But here.
There's a school of only 5 stories.
But let's be honest. What's really happening?
Because they know they're going to be behind. They're going to be behind. So why don't you plan that in?
But
here's they got the money for it already.
Yeah, but here's what's really going on. And you and I know this. There is a lot of savings, hence profit, to be made.
Yes,
they're building a nice building.
Yeah, the trailer profit.
Wheel in a trailer and go back to.
Who's getting that handled?
Like little plastic walls.
It must have been the same people that charged the bag at $750 million for.
It cracks me up. Every time I go into one of these things, the little flimsy thing with the little wooden steps up to it, and I'm just like, what the heck? You know, they don't even have like.
And what happens if something goes, we have to set a runner to the main office because something went wrong inside the trailer.
Yeah. Like, it fell down. It blew over in a wind. Yeah, but anyway, it's just, I think it's a money scam that somebody came up with.
Yes, it's a money scam.
You know, if we build this structure, it costs $180, but if we just wheel in a trailer, we can pocket $50,000 apiece. Yeah, you know, that's what's going on. But our children suffer because of it. Thank you.
Oh, who cares about the children? Can we make some money on this?
I know.
Give me a freaking break, or as they used to say in Battlestar Galactica, give me a fracking break. Well, hey, guess what?
Speaking of fracking.
Canada.
No, how about global temperature?
Oh, yeah, we got to get to that.
We can get into fracking. Right.
Republican Senator Portman now back to gay marriage.
Oh, yeah, I saw that.
Listen, Mr. America, we have a flash. Senator Portman now backs gay marriage because his son is gay.
And that's exactly...
Give me a break.
Hey, listen. Republicans don't give a fracking anything about anyone until it affects them.
Of course not. Why should I?
That's the thing that
Who cares?
They have no compassion or understanding about other people.
They don't give a crack about you.
And then suddenly it's okay. And the gay is in my house. Oh, well,
the
gay. It must be okay.
Yeah.
You know,
the gay.
Yeah.
The gay.
We caught the gay. we caught the liberal disease, you know. And then suddenly it's okay. Yeah, it's just like the ones that always amaze me with the chains. You know, you're going around, you know, we've got Darth Vader and his wife who wrote lesbian porn. I mean, that's what she used to write. They withdrew that from print. But then anyway,
yeah, you can't find that anywhere.
Somehow they spawned some, you know, nicely beautiful opinionated lesbian children that then they go around having to be ultra conservative because of the times of winning the evangelical base or whatever. But why can't these people just be honest and just be understanding without having to, you know, go through the trauma? I mean, this guy has been going for years being a fierce opponent. I mean, he was for decades, you know, going, let's have laws against them, let's ban them, let's put it in the Constitution, let's do all this. And now suddenly, it's okay.
And now suddenly.
Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men? The shadow knows.
And by that, you mean what evil lurks in the robotic chamber?
I mean, give me a break. These guys, you, every time they get caught doing something, gee whiz, I'm with you. Oh, my son is gay. Oh, my daughter is gay. Oh, me, oh, my. I never felt that way.
Yeah.
Mitt Romney, 47%. That's not what I meant. I only went on to talk about it for 2 hours, but that's not what I meant. It was a flub-a-dub.
And when I wide stance at the airport, I never did that. I don't know what you mean. Yeah.
Well, now he's being investigated.
Guys, I know. Look, it's endless with these guys. I give hats off to Senator Portman. Thank you. Glad you joined the rest of the human race. And you've learned that. The game.
He would have been vice president if Romney would want to. Romney wanted him.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, well, that's before he got told.
I am sure that he told Romney, my son is gay. And that's why he wasn't picked for vice president.
You know, I don't actually even think that.
I do.
It may have been. Romney is
a bird that does things by the letter. Nothing gets by him.
Well, I think no. I think Romney actually is just so craven, right?
Okay.
I think he had his, you know, he probably chose this guy and he was all happy with it. They're good friends and he thought he was the man and he was going to be, you know, standing by his friend until, you know, Alice in Wonderland showed up and they took him in the back room and they had a tea party. And then the Tea Party said, you're going to do what we say, or we're going to collapse the Congress. And then he went running away with his tail between his
legs. I think they found out that he was gay, and that's when the Tea Party went in and said,
I don't think anybody knew. I think Portman would have just kept it under wraps until, you know, afterwards, because it would have been, you know, could have been a deal blower for the office.
Everybody was wondering why he wasn't picked.
Well, this
everybody
is the thing.
Was wondering.
I don't think it was because of that. I literally think the Tea Party demanded their
seat.
Because, you know, they were saying all along, if you don't get our way, you know, the highway. That whole fiasco, they were going to shut down. You remember all that stuff. I think they demanded their seat at the table or else they were going to break the entire GOP in half. Remember, they were talking about seceding, forming their own party, and running themselves if they didn't get chosen, which that would have been far better if they wouldn't have. But I think they were just doing a big power play, and I think this guy didn't ever reveal anything until now. He probably just kept a seat because, you know, this would have been huge, ripping news. They would have kept it quiet. It would have been all through that evangelical community because that's what they live and breathe. You know, there's nothing but gays and abortions in America in their minds. So they would have been talking about this for months and months and months and smearing him because, you know, they've smeared Romney all over the place for not being hardcore enough, you know, not being right-wing enough. So they would have been tagging for this, for sure. I think it was simply the Tea Party demanding their pound of flesh, and they got it from him. And Romney, not having a backbone, didn't stand up to him and kicked his own choice off. Now, it so happens that, you know, his son has come out, and now he has come out in support of it like a normal person. But I don't think at the time that played a factor.
Well, I think you're being very nice. Romney's backbone is that arrogant, stuck-up wife of his.
That's
who Romney's backbone is. She will kick his butt.
Yes.
His fracking butt in a minute. She will do that. And the thing is that that's what I believe is the thing behind it, why Portman wasn't taken. And, you know, he wrestled with this. Oh, do I carry my son out in the cold? Oh, my God. This is so ludicrous.
Yeah.
This is so ludicrous. It don't happen like that. And, hey, it ain't going to happen like that in my life.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, who cares?
Yeah, exactly.
Damn not.
Well, that's what.
You don't want now. Wait, old times when you were bathing your child, when he was a baby, he was thinking this, or he was the gay way.
Yeah, no, that's what it says. Like, they act like.
It was Broadway.
It's like when you catch the gay.
Yeah, he caught the gay.
You go detrain them in a de-education
camp. Sick.
And this is one of the things that, you know, his statement was that ultimately for me, this is his quote, ultimately for me, it came down to the Bible's overarching themes of love and compassion and my belief that we are all children of God. And that's why he had.
Oh, so before that, we weren't children of God.
No, I think before that, he was just burning people at the stake. But he decided, because it's his own job, that now, looking at Christ's message of compassion and love, that it was okay. You know, let's forget and turn the other cheek. But what I wish they would learn is, it's the same message that's always been there, and quit being so hardcore about this, and quit crucifying gays, you know?
And here's what his son says, Portman's son, now a junior at Yale University, told the senator that being gay was not a choice,
exactly.
And that he had been gay since he could remember.
Right. I mean, that's the way it is. People are genetically, you know, coded for things, just like you're a boy or a girl or whatever. You don't just go through life thinking, hey, I think I'll choose something that will ostracize me and get me beaten up.
Right. Yeah, let me be gay.
This will be great. I think I'll
lose
something that would destroy my parents' lives and make them cast out of the party. You know, This is just
all. He said that his voice on the matter had evolved over the past 2 years, and he consulted clergy members and friends, including Vice President Darth Vader Cheney, who has an openly gay daughter.
Yeah, I guess he would be the guy to go to about gay issues. But, you know, Cheney's
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Portman.
Well, being in a such a go frack yourself hardcore dude that he likes to strut around the Senate like that. Cheney's been completely weak and hiding.
He's ahead. We don't know he's hiding. He's behind something. He's behind door one.
Yeah.
Or maybe it's door two.
I think it's just the door of the crib.
Okay, so have you been feeling hot lately?
The which?
Been feeling hot lately? Oh, look at that. Warmer than normal lately?
Yeah, let me put it this way. Every tree in my yard has already bloomed and is covered. No, what are you talking about? I got flowers and leaves on everything in my entire yard.
Global temperatures are warmer than any time in the last 4,000, that's 4K, years. Scientists reported Thursday, and over the coming decade, are likely to surpass levels not seen on the planet since before the last ice age.
Yeah. Well, look, and not only that, if you look at the...
Oh, those were all Democratic scientists.
Scientists are only liberal, so it's all a lie, right? You got your facts. I got my facts. That's what they say. But no, so if you look at the chart, though, it's not just a... general rise, it's been rising for the last 4,000 years. No, it's like this, and then at the last 50, it goes, and it's a Mount Everest spike straight up.
When
because it's directly related to the pollution.
When Ford Company first came out, the first automobile.
Well, so what we're doing though is we're having a 4,000 year spike, but all within the last half of our century.
It says here previous research had extended back roughly 1,500 years and suggested that the rapid temperature spike of the past century, believed to be consequential of human activity, exceeded any warming episode during those years. The new work confirms the result while suggesting the modern warming is unique over a longer period. Even the temperature increase with human activity that is projected for later this century comes out on the low end of the estimate. Scientists say the planet will be at least as warm as it was during the warmest period of the modern global era, known as the Holocene, and probably warmer than that.
Yep. And if you look on this, it says we are going up exponentially. So if we don't radically alter our behavior and what we're spewing into the atmosphere.
Oh, you mean those golf sacks?
Well, just think of it. Last 100 years, we've got 4,000 year heat spike.
Well, you see all the smoke coming out of that you see all the smoke coming out of that smoke sack?
Yeah.
The Pope was left there. I mean, those people must have been coughing like cracking coughing down there.
they're probably,
they've been doing that for 3,000 years.
Or
2,000 years, they've been doing that. No wonder so that's the cause. It's that smoke set that they built when he elected Pope.
It's all the popes.
Oh, man, and 226 popes. Holy fracking. That's unbelievable.
Well, you think, they got all those catacombs underneath there. They've just been piling bodies on the old...
Look,
we really do have a serious problem, and if we don't change things, because notice this word that they use, sharp vertical spike, that is the part that's worrisome. It's directly related to our activity, and if we do not change it, it's only getting worse and getting higher, and we're going to end up, I don't want to be on the upper end of 4,000 and then going for, an 8,000.
I won't be here, so I don't care.
I know you don't care. But, my children will be, so I care. Just like we had that little talk about building schools, we don't need to build them of, asbestos just to keep them from burning up,
Hey, listen, they didn't build the Vatican with asbestos and it's still standing. I mean, I had a problem with my washing machine. The switch in the washing machine stopped working. So I had to fix all that stuff. I pushed it up. I got it set up where it was working. But then the drum, the agitator broke. And, hey, gotta get somebody to fix this. So homeowner's policy, got somebody to come over here. He said, yeah, agitator is
Not where he's got three or four pins broken. He said, I don't have one with me, but I don't have the pins that I can fix the switch. He says, this washing machine, any other problems? I said, no. I said, and it's 20 years old. He said, what? I said, yeah. He said, my gosh. He said, and I'll tell you something right now. Those parts are still working. The parts I'm putting in now will break before this washing machine breaks.
Yeah.
He said, because they don't make parts like you have in here. These are the original parts.
Yeah. No, they don't.
They don't make like that.
Here's the thing. You know, our house, we went out to, we got all these new appliances. They were telling us, you know, used to, you could count on, you know, 10, 20 years on anything, though. They're telling us new appliances, they give you like maybe 4 years.
Yeah.
That's ridiculous. You pay premium, top dollar stuff, you got a new refrigerator, and they just laugh walking off like, hope it doesn't break before
that's
you get out
where
the
they
door.
Make their money.
Yeah, they make
them. Extended contracts.
What they call it, built-in obsolescence,
yeah,
too.
Yeah,
they make them break. Everything is flat.
Cars?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Look, yeah, you know
that. Not guns.
That we had, that white green car, like you said, right? One day, now there's a, when I first had the car, it had all this molding on the side to make it look like it was swoopy, but it was plastic. I mean, we didn't know. It looked like it's metal, all painted, everything's like, we got to get it, close the door with that, whole side of the car falls off on the ground. We go open the door, look down there, and it's just like plain metal, and then all this plastic molding, the fancy swoop, everything on the ground, just laying there. Take it to the place, and they're like, oh yeah, the plastic clips broke off. Sorry about that.
Yeah.
And they put new clips on it, and he just snapped it back on the side, and he goes, there you go, all fixed. Took 5 minutes, but I was looking at him. I went, you mean this whole thing is all just plastic and just held together with snap tight clicks? And he was like, yep. And I said, oh, I hope I don't get in a wreck, because I'm going to die.
Oh, joy, unbelievable.
I mean, that's the way they build things now, though. You know, it's all about profit. It costs money to build things that last, right? There's no profit in that.
Profit. Oh, you know, it's not profit. I was listening to my show, which I love, you know, coast to coast last night. It was at 1 o'clock.
All that crazy stuff you listened to, Mike.
And, man,
crazy.
I got so mad. He needs to start bringing people on with another thought in their head, except Obama is bad and that the black-hooded criminals are coming to take their guns.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the reason why we got these crazy nut jobs running around here, because they believe that Governor or Senator Clinton, now President Clinton, is going to take your gun. It is so stupid.
Well, it's
idiotic.
Yeah. These people are, you know, the black helicopters are coming, and Obama's out to, you know, steal, well, probably just the white people's guns, but still everybody's guns, you know. And, no, it is kind of, it's laughable, except, you know, when you have Ted Nugent standing up there, you know, oh, either be in jail or dead by the time he's, it's all funny until they shoot another person, you know, because that's what's going to happen. There is going to be some nutbag somewhere. He takes it upon himself, just like, for instance, when Palin had targets over all these Democratic.
Oh, yeah. It was a mistake.
And they went and shot our sitting congresswoman and almost killed her. And did kill several of her friends and staff. So, you know, it isn't fanciful. It isn't made up. It isn't funny. It's real life when you're telling people day and night that the government is against you. The government is the problem, and the solution is a gun in your hand firing at the government.
The New York Jets.
No, I'm going to hold you to an answer on that. What makes America the greatest country in the world?
Well, Lewis and Sharon said it, diversity and opportunity and freedom and freedom.
I'm not letting you go back to the airport without answering the question.
Well, our Constitution is a masterpiece. James Madison was a genius. The Declaration of Independence is, for me, the single greatest piece of American writing. You don't look satisfied.
One's a set of laws and the other's a declaration of war. I want a human moment from you. What about the people? Why is America
not the greatest country in the world, Professor? That's my answer.
You're saying...
Yes.
Let's talk about...
Fine. Sharon, the NEA is a loser. Yeah, it accounts for a penny out of her paycheck, but he gets to hit you with it any time he wants. It doesn't cost money. It costs votes. It costs airtime and column inches. You know why people don't like liberals? Because they lose. If liberals are so fucking smart, how come they lose so goddamn always?
Hey.
And with a straight face, you're going to tell students that America is so star-spangled awesome that we're the only ones in the world who have freedom? Canada has freedom. Japan has freedom. The UK, France, Italy, Germany, Spain, Australia, Belgium has freedom. So 207 sovereign states in the world, like 180 of them have freedom.
All right.
And you got you, sorority girl. Just in case you accidentally wander into a voting booth one day, there's some things you should know. And one of them is there is absolutely no evidence to support the statement that we're the greatest country in the world. We're 7th in literacy, 27th in math, 22nd in science, 49th in life expectancy, 178th in infant mortality, 3rd in median household income, number 4 in labor force, and number 4 in exports. We lead the world in only 3 categories. Number of incarcerated citizens per capita, number of adults who believe angels are real, and defense spending, where we spend more than the next 26 countries combined, 25 of whom are allies. Now, none of this is the fault of a 20-year-old college student, but you nonetheless are, without a doubt, a member of the worst period, generation, period, ever, period. So when you ask what makes us the greatest country in the world, I don't know what the fuck you're talking about. Yosemite? Sure used to be. We stood up for what was right. We fought for moral reasons. We passed laws, struck down laws for moral reasons. We waged wars on poverty, not poor people. We sacrificed. We cared about our neighbors. We put our money where our mouths were, and we never beat our chests. We built great big things, made ungodly technological advances, explored the universe, cured diseases, and we cultivated the world's greatest artists and the world's greatest economy. We reached for the stars, acted like men. We aspired to intelligence. We didn't belittle it. It didn't make us feel inferior. We didn't identify ourselves by who we voted for in the last election, and we didn't scare so easy. We were able to be all these things and do all these things because we were informed by great men, men who were revered. First step in solving any problem is recognizing there is one. America is not the greatest country in the world anymore. Enough?